Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 7th of January. The US air safety regulator has grounded more than 170 planes after a panel blew out of a Boeing 737 MAX airliner in midair.
I look to my left and there's this huge chunk, part of the airplane, just like missing. And the wind is just extremely loud. There's wind blowing everywhere.
The Israeli army says it's broken Hamas's military structure in northern Gaza. And as eastern Ukraine is hit by a deadly Russian missile strike, we hear about those risking their lives in Crimea to help Ukraine fight back.
There was a terrible moment just after I'd been investigating an object. I wanted to hide unnoticed, but I saw Russian servicemen. They just miraculously didn't talk to me. I was petrified.
Also in the podcast, an Iranian woman flogged for not wearing a hijab speaks out about her ordeal. And the palace, where Alexander the Great was crowned King of Macedonia, reopens after more than a decade. Nearly 5 years ago, all Boeing 737 MAX airliners were grounded after two crashes, which killed a total of 346 people. Boeing made changes to the automated flight control system and the jet was returned to service. But now the US air safety regulator has ordered 170 MAX 9 aircraft to undergo immediate checks before they're allowed to fly again. It followed a shocking incident when a panel blew out of an Alaska Airlines flight from Oregon to California. From Washington, Shingai Nyoka sent this report.
Flight 1282, carrying 177 passengers, was 35 minutes into its journey from Oregon to Ontario, California, when part of the fuselage was torn off, leaving a hole in the side of the aircraft. The pilot was forced to alert aircraft control to the severity of the situation.
Emergency, we are depressurized. We do need to return back.
Passengers spoke of hearing a loud bang before emergency oxygen masks dropped. Video footage shot on board shows the dangling masks and a huge gap where the windows should have been, and the passengers themselves staying remarkably calm.
I look to my left and there's this huge chunk, part of the airplane, just like missing. And the wind is just extremely loud. There's wind blowing everywhere.
It was a trip from hell.
The plane landed safely at Portland to the relief of all on board, among them Evan Smith.
There's not anything I have any control over, and it's just wait and see what happens. And they said there was a kid in that row who his shirt was sucked off him and out of the plane, and his mother was holding on to him to make sure he didn't go with it.
Alaska Airlines said in a statement that inspections on more than a quarter of the 737-9 fleet were completed so far, with no concerning findings. But there are growing questions as to how a new jet delivered in late October and certified in early November could have developed this problem. This is the latest mishap involving Boeing's best-selling model. The planes were grounded for almost 2 years following crashes in 2018 and 2019. Alaska Airlines, the National Transport Safety Board, and the Federal Aviation Authority have all confirmed that they will launch investigations into the incident.
Shingai Nyoka reporting from Washington. 3 months after the massacre of the 7th of October, Israel says it has completed the dismantling of Hamas's military framework in the northern Gaza Strip. It said it had killed around 8,000 militants there. Our correspondent Wira Davis reports from Jerusalem.
More than 22,000 people have been killed by Israel's bombing campaign in Gaza, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. But Israel has vowed that campaign will continue methodically in central and southern Gaza until its mission is accomplished. In a statement released 3 months to the day since the war began, an Israeli army spokesman said it had successfully disrupted Hamas operations in much of northern Gaza, including Jabalia, rendering them incapable of organised action. Last month, the Israeli army said it had tragically and mistakenly killed three hostages, Yotam Haim, Alon Shamritz and Samar El-Talalka. they had been held by Hamas in Gaza after being abducted on October the 7th. A new video released by Hamas on its social media channels features statements from the three men sometime before they died. In the video, which was filmed under duress, they suggest that the places in which they were being held were under Israeli bombardment and they were moved frequently. Hamas says a fourth hostage in the video, identified as Sahi Idan, was also killed in an Israeli airstrike, a claim that has not been verified. The message from the Hamas video is that Israel is killing its own and that the shelling should stop.
Wera Davis. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has now begun his latest diplomatic mission to the region. As he prepared to travel to Jordan, he said America wanted to stop any escalation in the fighting.
It is vital that we engage in this diplomacy now, both for the sake of the future for Gaza itself and more broadly, the sake of the future for Israelis and Palestinians and for the region as a whole. There is clearly a strong desire among the majority of people in the region for a future that is one of peace.
However, clashes on Israel's northern border have already intensified, with the powerful Lebanese group Hezbollah launching a barrage of rockets in what it said was its initial response to the assassination of a Hamas leader in Lebanon earlier in the week. Israel has not reported any casualties in the attacks on Saturday and said it had retaliated. The European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell, who is currently in Beirut, said it was imperative to avoid Lebanon being dragged into a wider regional conflict. The Lebanese caretaker prime minister, Najib Mikati, assured him that the Lebanese government was doing all it could to try to avoid a war.
The Lebanese government is actively seeking to de-escalate and Lebanese are exercising self-restraint. The first is to avert a war that will have terrible consequences regionally and internationally. Second issue, only political solution will put an end to the conflict in the Middle East.
Najib Mikati. Israel and Hezbollah have exchanged fire across the border almost daily since the Gaza war began. For more on that and details of the latest strikes on Israel by Hezbollah, I spoke to our Beirut correspondent Hugo Bachega.
It was a massive rocket attack. Hezbollah said it had fired more than 60 rockets at positions in northern Israel. The Israeli military said it had identified dozens of launches from Lebanon. So tensions have been high, but what happened this morning was unusual. I think it's also very interesting that we heard from the caretaker prime minister here in Lebanon talking about the need to prevent an escalation of the crisis. He's in a very difficult position because he's got virtually no influence over what Hezbollah decides to do, this powerful Shia movement that is supported by Iran and acts as a state within a state here in Lebanon. So it's a very difficult position for the Lebanese authorities as well. Up until now, Hezbollah's actions have been really calculated because lots of people here still remember what happened in 2006, the war between Israel and Hezbollah, the destruction that was brought by this conflict. So I think even Hezbollah, they are calculating their actions to try to prevent a major response from Israel.
At the start of the war in Gaza, it was suggested Israel didn't want to see an upsurge in fighting on its northern border, i.e. with Hezbollah. Has that calculation changed? Because we've recently heard comments from a number of Israeli leaders saying time is running out for a solution to the problems on that northern border.
Yeah, so we heard from the defense minister who said there was a short window for a diplomatic solution to try to ease tensions along the Israel-Lebanon border. There has been a massive disruption to life in that part of the country because of these constant attacks by Hezbollah. And well, the authorities are saying that this situation is unsustainable and they need to restore security in northern Israel. So you had the defense minister saying that there was possibility still of a diplomatic solution. But at the same time, some senior figures in the Israeli government defend a larger offensive against Hezbollah to reduce the threat posed by the group and obviously these attacks that have been carried out by Hezbollah.
And that was Hugo Bachega in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. In recent weeks, both Russia and Ukraine have stepped up their attacks on each other's territory with some of the heaviest bombardments since Russia invaded nearly 2 years ago. The latest Russian missile strike on the eastern Ukrainian town of Pokrovsk has left 11 people dead, including 5 children, according to local officials. The town is in Ukrainian-held territory in the partly occupied Donetsk region. More from our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse.
Rescue teams are sifting through rubble after Russian forces reportedly hit Pokrovsk and the surrounding area with missiles typically used in air defence systems. It's a relatively small city with a pre-invasion population of 60,000. Yet, people have been returning to live there despite warnings from officials that it's too dangerous. It saw a deadly bombardment last August, which left 9 people dead and more than 80 injured. In his evening address, President Zelensky said Russia should always feel consequences for these kind of attacks. Earlier this week, Ukrainian forces launched more than 70 drones across the border into Russia after Moscow launched its biggest aerial bombardment. It's led to evacuations in the southwestern city of Belgorod.
James Waterhouse. One of Ukraine's main targets is Russian-occupied Crimea. The peninsula was illegally annexed by Moscow in 2014. But following Russia's full-scale invasion, a resistance movement has sprung up there. It says it's aiding Ukrainian attacks with vital intelligence. Our correspondent Jessica Parker has been in contact with 5 men who say they are spying for Ukraine inside Crimea. Here is one with his words spoken by an actor.
I had a hunch that someone was always watching. I don't know why. I was constantly looking around. My heart was pounding.
A man who we're calling Agent One describes taking photos as he crouches down behind some bushes.
You hear about the work of partisans. Doing the work is quite another.
Via a messaging app, he tells us about his secret life, spying on the Russian military in occupied Crimea.
There was a terrible moment just after I'd been investigating an object. I wanted to hide unnoticed, but I saw Russian servicemen. They just miraculously didn't talk to me. I managed to lean down by the car and pretended that I had a problem with the wheel. I was petrified.
Agent One gets away safely. He and others have told us they're part of a resistance movement called Atesh. It means fire in the Crimean Tatar language. A woman cries out. She's seen an explosion. It's an attack on 2 Russian warships stationed in Sevastopol. That's Crimea's biggest city, where last September, Ukraine would also go on to hit the HQ of Russia's Black Sea Fleet. It made international news.
Certainly, it appears that Russia's Black Sea naval headquarters in Sevastopol has been directly hit.
Atesh says its intel aided these attacks and others. Agent One says he knows he's doing dangerous work.
If I get noticed by the Russians, I think I'll be reported right away.
Agent One's account and those of 4 more men we've been in contact with can't be independently verified. They won't reveal their identities. But a senior source within Ukraine's defence and intelligence services says the testimonies are credible. Agent One believes his work is valuable.
I have been informed more than once that thanks to my coordinates or photos, Russian equipment was destroyed. This inspires me to continue to liberate Crimea.
Some Russian media bloggers dismiss Atesh as an invention of Ukrainian intelligence designed to overstate levels of resistance. Yet Atesh is reportedly designated by Russia as a banned terrorist organization. Being caught could mean a lengthy jail term.
Of course there are risks, because we live in terrible conditions of propaganda and control.
So why would spies inside Crimea talk to us? Our main contact, who says he's a handler based in unoccupied Ukraine, tells us that Atesh hopes to expand its network. Agent One says he wants to send a message.
I agreed to talk to you in order to convey information to people that Crimeans are not all zombies here and are ready to resist even in conditions of total censorship.
Atesh even claims to have agents within Russia's military. But the world of espionage is a murky one, showing again that this war stretches far beyond the battlefield.
That report by Jessica Parker. Ahead of today's election, Bangladesh has been hit by a spate of violence and arson attacks. Both the government and opposition have accused each other of carrying out acts of sabotage. The main opposition party, the BNP, is boycotting the vote, calling it a sham, and has started a 2-day strike across the country.
Bangladesh!
There are 120 million eligible voters in Bangladesh, but this protester, Arman Ul Haq, won't be taking part.
This is not a participatory election because we can see that BNP and other political parties are not joining in this election. So we are young. We can't trust this election.
Well, as a result of the boycott, it looks clear that the current Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and her ruling Awami League will secure a fourth term in office. Our South Asia regional editor Sanjay Dasgupta told me about the latest trouble in Bangladesh.
Reports of violence of arson continue to grow. At least 14 polling stations have been set on fire. These are mostly school buildings which are used as voting centres. A Buddhist temple in the city of Chittagong has been torched. Chittagong now is known as Chattogram. Goods trucks are being attacked on national highways. Earlier on Saturday, the Bangladesh Fire Service said there had been at least 14 arson attacks in 16 hours till 9:30 a.m. in the morning local time. There was a moving train which was set on fire yesterday by suspected arsonists. Four people died, two of them children. There was another attack on another moving train a week ago. Another four people died.
And the police have arrested seven opposition members and blaming them for that attack on the train on Friday. The government says the opposition is trying to undermine the poll. Is that a credible accusation?
Now, among those opposition activists arrested is a guy called Nobiullah Nobi, who is quite a senior leader of the main opposition BNP party. He is behind bars, suspected of having participated in that arson attack. Now, the opposition has been demanding for some time that, as on previous occasions in Bangladesh, the political tradition was that the government in power would step down, hand over to a caretaker administration, usually a Supreme Court judge, and elections would be held under the caretaker administration. This, the opposition says, ensures a free and fair poll. Now, it has to be said, this has been tried in Bangladesh before and has worked in the past. The opposition was demanding the same this time and the government has refused. This is why the opposition cries foul. This is why they say we won't participate in the polls. Even the UN has expressed concern.
Given everything we're seeing in Bangladesh, can the election on Sunday be free and fair?
The Chief Election Commissioner of Bangladesh, Qazi Habibul Awal, actually held a press conference today. His upbeat tone flew not only in the face of logic, but in the face of the facts on the ground. He seemed to suggest that the elections would be free and fair.
We are convinced that the public servants who will be handling the election or polling and allied matters would be sincerely, honestly and faithfully discharging their duties. And we are hopeful election to be free, fair and credible.
He has also said he was worried about incidents of violence, which he described as attempts to sabotage the elections. Now, that's interesting because the opposition is also saying that the government has pre-planned these acts of sabotage. So both sides are actually accusing each other of pre-planning acts of violence to sabotage the elections.
Our South Asia regional editor Sanjay Dasgupta. Alexander the Great was one of the most successful military leaders of all time, undefeated at his death in 323 BC. Here are the words of the Greek historian Plutarch, describing one of his many victories.
Fortune was not kind to Alexander in the choice of battleground, but he was able to turn this to his advantage. Fighting alongside his men on the front line, he put the barbarians to flight. Nothing was wanting to complete this victory, in which he overthrew more than 110,000 of his enemies.
Well, now the palace where Alexander the Great was crowned King of Macedonia has been reopened. It follows a 16-year restoration of the site in the Greek port city of Thessaloniki and a much longer period of excavations before that. Here's our Europe analyst, Charles Haviland.
The Palace of Ege near Thessaloniki was the largest building in classical Greece, but was destroyed by the Romans and was unearthed through excavations from 1865 onwards. The newly restored or rebuilt sections include massive colonnades. Here, before 8,000 people, Alexander the Great was proclaimed king more than 2,300 years ago, after the assassination of his father Philip, who'd had the palace built. The military campaigns that followed saw Alexander create a Macedonian empire stretching from Egypt to Armenia to India. Greece's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, described Friday's reopening as an event of global importance.
Charles Haviland. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
This is the first of its kind, so it is history in the making, and as a Ghanaian, I'm actually proud to be part of it.
A world cooking record in Ghana. The military government in Myanmar has admitted that it has lost control of a key town near the Chinese border, its biggest defeat in a recent offensive by an alliance of ethnic rebel groups. The fighting has strained relations with China, which, despite being an ally of Myanmar's military junta, was willing to let the rebels capture the town of Lao Cai. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head explains.
China has a lot of influence over these groups. They can't operate without China at least tacitly allowing them to. And it's been a long game where China's backed them because they're very powerful in their own areas and it's close to the Chinese border, while at the same time backing the Myanmar government and giving it diplomatic support. In this particular case, China seems to have allowed the Myanmar military to take a very significant defeat because of the public pressure to shut down these scam centres in this area being operated by pro-military warlords and crime syndicates for a long time, and the Chinese government was very upset about these scam centres. Thousands of Chinese have been trafficked and trapped in these scam centres, being forced to work. And this group that's taken over this town of Lao Cai say they've shut down 300 scam centres, sent 40,000 people back to China. It's been a big deal. For now, China is happy to see this happen. Whether China's willing to see the military badly damaged to the point where it loses control is a different matter. I think China fears the kind of chaos that might follow if the military regime collapsed completely, so we may see changes in Chinese policy in the next few months.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head. An Iranian woman subjected to dozens of lashes for refusing to wear a hijab has set out a detailed description of the brutal punishment. Her account has provoked strong reactions online, as our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports.
The Kurdish-Iranian activist Raya Heshmati has published a vivid account of a sentence to 74 lashes meted out to her on Wednesday. She'd been arrested for posting a photo of herself without the hijab on a main street in Tehran. She says the room where she was flogged was like a medieval torture chamber. She says a headscarf was forcibly placed on her head and she was then beaten on her shoulder, her back, her buttocks and her legs. She says she chanted the main slogan of a mass movement against the hijab that convulsed Iran last year as she was being flogged. Woman, life, freedom. Many have hailed her online as a heroine.
Sebastian Usher. Now, let's go back to September and the launch of India's solar mission, Aditya L1, named after the Hindu sun god.
3, 2, 1, 0. Lift off, normal.
P1 tracking.
PC tracking.
Magnificent liftoff of PSLV C-57 with Aditya L1 on board.
Well, on Saturday, the craft completed the 1.5 million kilometre journey to reach its intended destination in space, the so-called Lagrange Point L1, where it can remain in a stable orbit and continuously observe the sun for the next 5 years. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, described it as an extraordinary feat. One of those involved in the project is the astrophysicist Professor Somak Ray Chowdhury, Vice-Chancellor of Ashoka University. He's been talking to James Kumarasamy.
It's a very new thing for India. Such an orbit has never been done by Indian technology. We've reached there and it's perfectly placed in a very complicated orbit in a place which is between the sun and the earth. It's a culmination of 10 years worth of work, but also the beginning of a great scientific journey. The job of the satellite is to look at the sun without being blocked by the Earth. It's got many instruments, but the two major instruments are to take ultraviolet images of the sun. And then also there's a spectrograph that takes spectra of the corona of the sun, which is 10 times larger than the sun, and looks at the connection between the surface of the sun and the corona of the sun. And so the idea is to monitor the sun without a break.
And what about the differences in heat between the surface and the corona? Is observing the sun going to help work out why it's such a big difference?
Yeah, that's the other thing. The sun's surface is 6,000 degrees, whereas the corona, which is just outside the sun's surface, is a few million degrees. And how heat is transported out of the sun as it comes to us, it passes through this region around the sun that's full of charged particles, and it's so hot. So this particular satellite has two instruments. They look at what's happening between the two. So when a storm happens on the surface, of the sun, one looks at immediately at the same time the effect on the corona itself. And from that study, one can figure out how the energy is being exchanged.
And for us here on Earth, what would you say, apart from the scientific knowledge, what is the direct relevance of this?
What one studies is that over a period of 11 years, the solar cycle, the sun gets very, very active. And in the active period, there are lots of magnetic storms that happen on the surface of the sun. These storms can be as large as the Earth, and it produces millions of very energetic charged particles that are thrown out all over the solar system. Around the Earth, we have thousands and thousands of satellites. All of them have sensitive computers and electronic equipment, and these particles have started to affect them, and they can destroy them.
These have been rather good months for the Indian space program in general, haven't they?
Well, it's amazing to see first the moon mission and then Aditya go up. And then just on the 1st of January, the X-ray polarimetric satellite ExoSat went up. So all this has attracted so much public attention during the launch of both the moon mission and Aditya. School children cheering as if they were watching a cricket match. Broadcasts were watched by millions, hundreds of millions of people. Now I'm an educator also, right? Just to see how my students are interested at the university level, but also this makes me hopeful that we'll get a whole bunch of a new generation of students, high school students, who are getting interested in science and technology through missions like this, successes like this, and we will see a new generation, you know, coming in to do science.
Professor Somak Ray Chowdhury talking to James Kumarasamy. With competition from Amazon and supermarkets, independent bookshops have not had it easy of late. But here in the UK, the number of new independent booksellers is on the rise. In 2016, there were 867. Today, there are nearly 1,100. Tom Rowley opened his bookshop here in London a year ago. Sean Lay asked him what people thought of the idea.
I suppose they think bricks and mortar bookshop is quite a sort of fusty, old-fashioned thing these days. But actually, it's quite the reverse. Our average customer is in their 20s. They've grown up with Kindle, they've grown up with social media, and yet still they love to come into a real physical bookshop, browse the shelves, and often they'll pose with a stack of books and take a picture for their Instagram and then tag all of their friends in it.
As well as lots of books, there's something else you can do in your bookshop.
Oh, yes, that's right. You can drink coffee during the day, wine and beer in the evening. And I must say, we have discovered people tend to buy rather more books after a drink or two.
That may have been something the traditional booksellers had failed to spot. There are some interesting statistics that have come out which suggest that although there's been a net decline, the independent bookshop openings last year, 2023, were higher than a year before. That might surprise people because there are lots of high streets where there may not be a bookshop as such at all.
Yes, and I think the secret to it is community, really, and that's what we're offering as much as the chance to buy a book. I mean, that's why I call my bookshop Backstory, because anyone can buy any book they want online. What they're not going to get is the backstory. It's the opportunity to meet the author at an event or just kind of come out with a story of their own. Often we found it because sort of spontaneous conversations at our bar. And so they're coming out with a book, but they're also coming out with a sort of story of their own.
So it's a community as much as a shop.
I think that's right. I mean, we do our own magazine. We have music nights. We do book subscriptions where we sort of pick out books specifically for the person. And then we send them a little card. So they become pen pals of ours, even if they don't live nearby. And then it's a community for the team as well. I've got six booksellers and we go to the pub once a month and we call it Proofs and Pints. We talk about proofs that are coming up in the next few months, the new books, and which we are going to stock and which we're going to rave about.
Now, that's a really interesting point, which we're going to stock. How important is that in booksellers when you're up against top 10 book lists in supermarkets, you're up against mainstream news agents? How difficult is it to kind of chart an independent course?
It's absolutely vital. That's why, from the word go, I want not just me, but the whole team to be involved in buying. We all look at the catalogues months in advance, decide what we want to stock. We're always writing those little recommendation cards about what we liked about a particular book. And we try to just have fun with our shelves at the front of the shop, rather than just having the same old displays the big bookshops would have. So, for instance, we had a display of overlooked books. We asked customers to recommend 10 books that they think have been unfairly overlooked over the years, and we got them to write sort of little recommendations to each other. So it's making it a real sort of experience rather than just a kind of transaction.
Tom Rowley talking to Sean Lay. The people of Ghana have been making a name for themselves as world record challengers. You may have heard about one woman's continuous sing-a-thon, which made headlines recently after she ended up in hospital. Now another woman, Failatu Abdul Razak, is trying to break the record for continuous cooking. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
The distant sounds of music and drums coming from the hotel kitchen that's become home to Failatu Abdul Razak. No doubt helping keep the chef awake as she enters her sixth day of continuous cooking. On the menu, jollof rice and the traditional banku, a multi-purpose white dough, both of them labour-intensive to make. The world record attempt had an original goal of getting past the 119 hours and 57 minutes set by Irish chef Alan Fisher. But by Saturday morning, Failatu had reportedly surpassed that mark and upped her target to 240 hours. That was much to the excitement of her fans who'd gathered to watch, sing, dance and, of course, eat.
In terms of the cookathon, this is the first of its kind, so it is history in the making. As a Ghanaian, I'm actually proud to be part of it.
The former First Lady visited the hotel in Tamale to cheer Failatu on, a visit that left the exhausted chef in tears of joy. The rules set by Guinness World Records state she's only allowed a 5-minute break every hour or to take a full hour break after a 12-hour stretch of cooking. Something anyone who's cooked Christmas lunch can perhaps relate to, but Failatu has been at it since New Year's Day non-stop. For the fans, that's an inspiration.
It is an opportunity for the youth of today to know that whatever you choose to do, do it well and do it the best way.
The best way may also be a dangerous way, however. Experts warn the excitement of these sort of tasks can lead people to push themselves too far as they're running on adrenaline, and a recent record attempt for singing was called off by medical professionals. For now, though, Failatu and her trusty assistant seem to be doing well on the live stream on YouTube, and the only concern from fans is she may run out of food to cook before she runs out of the will to cook.
Stephanie Prentice. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back at the same time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Lewis Allsop and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Trip Planner by Expedia. You were made to have strong opinions about sand. We were made to help you and your friends find a place on the beach with a pool and a marina and a waterfall and a soaking tub. Expedia, made to travel.